You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 72 for November 25th, 2015. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about large project management in CRM. How is a large project even defined? What challenges are there to large versus small project management? We'll discuss these questions and more in the next hour. So, go get your copy of Small Project Management by Bill White so you can have something to read while on the site Porta Potty, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Steven in Calgary.
Hello.
And Sonia in Utah.
Hello.
And Sonia is new to the show. I'm hoping to have her on a little bit more regularly. Sonia, why don't you tell everybody real quick who you are and what your experience is and where you work?
Okay. My name is Sonia Hootmacher. I'm the principal investigator and owner of Desert West Environmental out of Ogden, Utah. I've got about 18 years of experience in cultural resources management, and just enjoy doing my work and running a business.
Awesome. And you are a good one to have on this show as sort of your first podcast as a co-host, because we're talking about large project management. And in your prior experience, you've probably dealt with that. And in your current position, I'm sure you're dealing with that or getting close to dealing with that.
Oh, yes. Very much so. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and Steven, as you guys have all heard on the show before, he used to work down in Wisconsin there and definitely managed a few large projects in his life.
Yes.
And now Steven's in Canada, and we were just talking before the show about how they define a large project, and that's one of the first things I want to talk about, because if we're going to talk about large project management in cultural resource management archaeology, we need to first define what large project means. So I want to get your guys' opinions on that. We'll start with that. And I think we'll start with you, Steven, because I'm thinking it has to be defined either by acreage or by the budget, or maybe some people even define it by the number of people you have to hire to accomplish that project. But then again, maybe not. I don't know. Because I'm managing a 30,000-acre project, but I only have 7 employees. It's just taking longer than if I'd hired 30 people to do it in a month and a half. So maybe people isn't a good definition, but who knows? So Steven, how do you define, or how did you define, how would you define a large project in the areas that you've worked, and then maybe versus where you're working now?
I think it can go either way. Sometimes it's acreage, or I don't want to say acreage, but like the amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a lot of work that has to get done, that really sounds like a large project to me. The other way is if there's a lot of staff. Either way, you're introducing a greater level of complexity into the project, and I think that that's a good way to think about it, is that it's not really like it's not a very digital thing where either it's a large project or it's not a large project, that there are projects of all different sizes and it just kind of scales. As you progress up the spectrum, you get more acres, you get more work to do, and then you have more people or just more, person hours, right? Whereas a small project, I think a small project's almost easier to define, where it would just be like for one or two people. Two people is kind of the norm here, but that's almost more for safety reasons than anything else. And just for a day or two or a couple of days or maybe a week.
Okay. Well, and it's difficult, I think, doing it based on people too, because like I said, the project I'm working on now, but I've also worked on shovel testing projects on the East Coast where it was only 3 or 4 of us, but we did it for like 2 months because there wasn't a huge press on the project, but we still dug, several thousand shovel tests across, multi-thousands of acres, which they defined as a large project out there. I remember we had a 2,000-acre shovel testing project, and it was one of the biggest ones most people at that company and most people that were hired had worked on, partly because, private land projects on the East Coast are typically smaller because of the, just the size of it. This was a massive housing development, so... But then 2,000 acres out here in the desert, we do that in about a week and a half. So,
Yeah.
Sure. And that's why I kind of threw out the idea of like person hours, that mm-hmm. You know, how many people you decide to get depends on like housing, vehicles, and other things, and how quickly you need to get it done. But you know, if it's 5,000 acres or 2,000 acres or you know, a lot of shovel tests or you know whatever, it you know really boots on the ground, like how many person hours are involved. That's a little bit more stable as a indicator or as a unit.
Right, right. Okay. Sonia, how do you guys define at your company what you, if you're telling somebody about a project, when would you use the word large versus small?
Oh, that's it's a great question, because I think that large project and small project definition is often based on an individual's experience.
Right.
I've been on $7 million projects, and I've been on you know, $500 projects or $200 projects. So, you know, a small project could be just the review of a cell tower application, but a large project could be, say, even a $120,000 data recovery project. But even to me, that seems kind of small. So I generally tend to look at project size based on the schedule, the number of people, and the cost of it. 5,000 acres to me is no big deal. 15 or 20,000 acres is a little bit different. A small little data recovery project can be tiny, or it can be quite large. I mean, and I know that's a vague answer, but I mean, after assisting with a $7 million project, everything else just seems really, really small. You know,
yeah.
It's hard for me to define sometimes. The other thing I have in terms of large project is also that degree of hassle factor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you guys have ever talked about the hassle factor on your podcast before.
I don't really think so. Why don't you go ahead and define that in your terms?
Well, there are projects and clients that take a little bit more management. And that adds cost to a project. I'm being diplomatic. There are projects that I would define as quite large and complicated, simply because the project manager for the client makes them large and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
They don't all need to be that way. So that little hassle factor also plays a little bit of a part.
Okay. Well, and we're going to talk about client interactions a little bit later too, as part of this. And that's one of the things I would agree that helps define a large versus small project is, what is your interaction with the client? Do they just throw you a proposal and you get it done, and you throw them back a letter report or a draft report, and that's pretty much it? Or mm-hmm. is there a lot of interaction in between, you mm-hmm. know, on a step-by-step basis? So I think we're coming down to, you know, project. What defines a large project is really partly based on your experience level and how you define a large project, but also sounds like budget and people are two big factors. I think acreage, I threw that in there because you say you're on a 30,000 acre project and that sounds huge, but depending on how that's tackled and how you handle it, you know, it's all relative. I know before this year, quite honestly, most of the surveys I'd been on in the Northern Great Basin were, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 acres. And that seemed big because up there, and again, that changes, you know, your perception of large project. And these would take a couple months to do, or at least, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to do, only because of the terrain. You know, we're in the basin and range system in Nevada, and it's just up, down, straight up and down these mountains and these hills. And, you know, we're not covering nearly the acreage that we would cover, say, down here in the desert where it's all flat. So, but we would also, Steven's mentioning that's quick in the background, but we'd also have usually 3 or 4 crews doing that too. So, you know, 3 or 4 crews of 4 people doing 2,000 to 5,000 acres, you can get that done in 6 weeks. So mm-hmm. Depending on the number of sites you have too, I mean, there's all kinds of factors that end up going in there. So,
and that's like pedestrian survey, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, but by like my Eastern woodland sensibility, that's like astonishingly fast.
Right.
Because, you know, like in the Eastern woodlands, you're digging shovel tests and you know, anywhere between like 10-meter intervals to like 30-meter intervals. And, you know, when you get to 5,000 acres or 10,000 acres, you know, particularly within a single year, that's a lot of work involving a lot of people. And you're talking, you know, upwards of like 15 to 20 people on your crew size, and maybe even have multiple crews out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really depends. You know, and that's the other thing, is like what the workload is. You know, because an excavation is a lot more labor intensive, and shovel testing is a lot more labor intensive, and it really varies.
Absolutely, and that's good to point out too, because I think that's going to affect our conversation later on about different factors that come into play here, because, you know, we're talking about calling a 5,000 acre shovel testing project would be a large project by our standards, but when it comes to client interaction, that may not be that large to them or that big of a deal, and in what you deal with, or maybe it is. It really just depends on the client and the situation. So, and just as a point of reference too, the large-ish shovel testing project, one of the ones I can remember on the East Coast on the Cape Fear River in North Carolina that I was part of, I think that was, like I said, 2,000 to 3,000 acres. It was all shovel testing, 30-meter transects, 30-meter intervals on the shovel tests, and 30-centimeter transects, or 30-centimeter shovel tests diameter, going down about 80 centimeters to a meter, and it's all in sand, so it's easy digging. But we were digging 60 to 80 shovel tests a day per person, and I mean, this still took us for, I think we had 5 or 6 people on the project, and it took us over 2 months, I think about two and a half months to do, give or take.
And how many acres of survey was that?
I think it was 2,000 to 3,000.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had vegetation issues. We had, heat issues and all kinds of stuff. We were still maintaining at a minimum, probably 60 shovel tests a day. I remember getting 80, 90, 100 shovel tests a day when you were in an area that was completely sterile. We ended up doing data recovery on a number of those sites. I was part of, I think, 2 of them, and they did a number of others. And the first one we were on, I don't remember what the volume was that we excavated, but we had tens of thousands of sherds that we took out of the data recovery. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was a monster project, which might also help define large and small project when you're talking about data recoveries. I mean, you might have what you think is a small project, and then you find 30,000 sherds that need to be processed in the lab, and it all of a sudden turns into a large project.
A buried pueblo.
right.
That happened.
Nice. Yeah, that happened on a project when I was down with MOAC down in Kanab, Utah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were just excavating and started finding these whole pots and all this stuff, and it turns out it went right underneath the road. So I don't know how they handled that later on, but we just kept getting closer and closer to the road, and we found out that they paved that road however many tens of years ago, like right over the top of this site. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. So let's move into challenges. Let's move into some challenges. Sonia, what are some unique challenges you think you've faced that might be similar to most large projects you've worked on that you wouldn't encounter, say, doing a cell tower or something like that?
Time management is probably a big one, especially with managing many, many people in the field. It gets very easy to lose track of how much time people are putting in, how much overtime people are putting in, what progress is being made during that. We can quantify it with numbers of hours and in dollars. But are we able to quantify that in terms of the numbers of excavation units? Are people keeping track of those things in the field? I mean, I can think of quite a few things off the top of my head just on the management side. In the field, GPS units, digital data, photographs, photo logs, FS logs, those things coming back in on larger projects, they're a mess, and it's not because people are trying to make it a mess. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. It's just people just start losing track of things.
Right.
So I would say those are a few of the larger issues that I've noticed. We try to keep track of it the best we can, but sometimes we end up with a random, like 10 photos that we have no idea how did we get off a set of numbers, or where did these photos come from, or and you have to go and track all those things back down.
I would have to agree with that. One of the things I've learned doing this, the current project that I'm on, is, you know, I started with one crew and I was on that crew, and then we added a second crew in October and I had a crew chief for that crew. And, you know, I figured we'd be able to nail down our procedures. I mean, all of us are really experienced in doing this stuff. So, you know, we didn't have a lot of things that caught us by surprise, but there were some unique challenges to managing our data when we first started this, and managing how we're doing site numbers and things like that. Because there are some areas out here where we'll do like a flag and run on the site, so we can just identify how many sites are in the area, and then we come back to it to record. And some of those sites that we thought were separate when we did the survey will maybe combine once we get it all flagged out, and then we free up a site number. And then because we're dealing with a prime contractor and they're dealing with some of the data, I didn't want to have gaps in the site number list. So then we reuse that site number, that temporary site number later on. So we have to have a list of those. And then you throw in the added complexity of, on certain parts of the area where we're working, we're not allowed to take photographs without a representative. And we can't get that representative until we have a chunk of sites that need photographs, and then they'll send somebody out and we can go take photographs. So we needed a way to not only manage taking photographs, but we need to be able to send out a person that probably wasn't even on the site and doesn't know anything about it, but knows exactly where to go to take all these photos. So we had to create these photo points files in the Trimble. And, you know, these are all things that we hadn't actually thought of from the get-go. But we're writing all this down, so the next time we do a project, either out here or of this complexity, you know, we'll have these issues worked out. But those are the kinds of things you just don't think about. And some of this didn't even rear its ugly head as a problem until several months into the project. And we realized, oh, crap, we should have been doing this all along, because now it's a monster.
Yep. You know, I was a subcontractor. So basically, they subcontracted my business to assist another archaeological firm do a project down in San Juan County in Utah, which, you know, is one of the densest counties for archaeological sites. Wonderful Anasazi and Puebloan archaeology down there.
Yeah.
The project manager and the principal field director for this business I was working for had actually never worked in that county before. And he said, so what are some of your recommendations? And I said, if you don't keep lists of every single thing you find, you're going to have a huge problem at the end.
Nice. Yeah.
And in 3,000 to 4,000 acres, I think he ended up with like 250 to 300 sites. And just keeping track of all of those sites and what had been visited and what had not been visited or and recorded. I mean, we were going back out and I would go out and I would find a datum in the ground. And I'm like, okay, so this site's already been recorded. Why are we back here? We're just wasting time.
Yeah.
So, you know, keep lists. I mean, if I'm going to give anyone a recommendation about a huge project, especially in that area, oh, for the love of God, just keep lists of every single thing you find.
Yeah, absolutely.
A feature or site, if not necessarily artifacts, but sites.
Absolutely. And I've got a lot more to add to that, as I'm sure Steven does, as far as organization goes. But we're going to throw it to our iPad mini promo real quick. We're giving away an iPad mini. Listen to this and find out how you can win it. We're going to do it in mid-December. So get on that and we'll be back in a minute. Hello, everyone. Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Podcast Network. And we're giving away an iPad mini 4 to one of our listeners. The iPad Mini 4 came out in September. It's a 16-gigabyte space gray iPad with AT&T cellular-ready antenna. All that means is it comes with a GPS. You do not need to get a data plan. And you don't even need to be on AT&T if you never get a plan to get a data plan. It just has GPS. It also has a fingerprint sensor and Apple Pay ready and all the good perks that come with that. So it's a good iPad. We use them in the field. There are two easy ways to enter. One, do a Profiles in CRM interview before December 15th, 2015, or recommend someone for an interview. You'll both get an entry once the interview is posted. If you want to know more about profiles in CRM, go to www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/profiles. All the questions are listed right there. The other way to enter is to like the APN Facebook page and share it with your friends on Facebook to get the word out about our awesome podcasts. The winner will be announced December 16th, 2015 at 4 p.m. Pacific time. So get your entries in, send me those emails for people that want to do the Profiles in CRM podcast, and good luck to everyone. iMac, take us out with a binary solo. All right, we're back, and we are joined also by Bill White down in Arizona. How's it going, Bill?
Howdy, good.
All right, so we're going to kick this back off talking about some of the challenges. And when we left, Sonia was talking about keeping lists and things like that. And I'll tell you what, I can't endorse that more. And I would say, and this is one thing I've kind of always done, but I've had to convince some of the people working for me to do the same, is write down absolutely everything. I mean, even if you think it's not useful right now, I'm keeping data on this project that I don't know if anybody's ever going to see or use. Just like data about how we're doing the project. I don't know if it's going to be useful later on, but maybe it is. And I figured while we're doing this, I'm going to, you know, record these types of information. All kinds of little things from daily acreage per person, what types of terrain we're encountering, how many sites we recorded versus that acreage, you know, stuff like that. All kinds of little things that we're keeping track of. And not only that, but the way my client, who's the prime contractor, gave us the maps for this project are as basically we've got it split up into blocks. They renumbered what's basically USGS section blocks. They didn't give, I don't know why they didn't use the original section numbers, but they renumbered the whole project area using those blocks. So we've got like, I don't know, 150 USGS section blocks that we're surveying, give or take. Not in their entirety. It's a weird geometry within those. But he gave us a PDF of each one of these blocks, basically, a PDF that includes everything. And we use iPads for everything. So we're out there, my crew chiefs, myself included, when we go do and we line out our transects and we figure out what we're going to do, we basically draw right on the map on the iPad our lines and then our numbers that we're going to walk for the trembles and stuff like that. And we usually do that before we go in the field so people aren't standing there waiting for us, but or we have somebody do it on the way to the project area. And that's what we're doing. Well, I've got a couple people that don't, you know, sometimes they don't always put their transects in and then they're like, well, I'm probably coming back out to this area and I don't have time and I don't want to do it right now. So they don't write it down. And then we don't come to that area for a month and a half and either they've forgotten what they did or somebody else is doing it. And they don't have those lines to go from. They don't know what's been done right there. We have the data elsewhere, but it would be easier just to see it right there and to just do it. And I guess the point of all this is on a large project, it's beneficial to take the extra couple minutes sometimes to record something or write something down that you're not sure might be important later on. Or, you know, you just maybe it doesn't have any utility later on. Who knows? But you don't know. And that's the point. Steven, you got something to add to this?
Yeah, I think that gets to one of my big considerations with large projects is that when you have a small project, your data can be messy. And you know, because you went out there, you did 10 shovel tests for the entire thing. And, you know, you can sift through it, you know, that and the 15 photographs that you took pretty easily when you get back to the office. But when you have thousands of photographs and thousands of shovel tests or, you know, acres or anything like that, you really don't, you know, like the amount of inefficiencies of having to sort through that after the fact just becomes daunting. I mean, it becomes huge. It just, you know, builds up. So it's really important to think ahead in how you're going to organize everything. You know, so much as like operationalize how that process is gonna go, and you know, in order to minimize the amount of, you know, catch up time that you're gonna have to spend, and you know, the other thing, and I think you kind of hit on this, is that you can't assume that you're going to be the one looking at the notes later. If you've got 15 people working on your crew and like three of them end up working on the report, it might be some other person who's dealing with that. And you can't expect to A, remember, or B, you know, that you're even going to be the one, you know, trying to deal with, you know, whatever you put down there. So a certain level of standardization really, really helps.
I actually keep quite a bit of data on progress made in the field, numbers and types of sites that we find while we're out doing our surveys. But I also keep some digital data. Each one of my archaeologists goes out with a Garmin GPS unit that keeps track of where they were and basically time. Their start and stop points. I usually ask them to drop a waypoint in that Garmin. It's not used to record archaeological sites, but it is helpful because it's easy and it's fast.
Right.
It's very quick to drop a waypoint in a Garmin GPS than it is in a Trimble. I keep track of acres surveyed complete, like for the entire crew or crews, where they were working, what time they started and stopped, how long it takes them to get to the project area. I even keep track of health and safety issues, and when we do that health and safety meeting in the morning, what we go over. It's not just to protect the crew; it's also to protect the data that we're pulling out of the field. I've had clients come back and say, "Well, we need proof that this happened on this day," and I can say, "Well, here's a copy of the health and safety plan that we did for that day. Here's our tracks. Here's all this data that shows we were physically out there and how much work we got done."
You might not even need that for the entire project, but that one time that you do need it, you'll be glad you had it.
You'll be glad you had it. I can't tell you how important that stuff is. And, you know, many, many times, sometimes my crew will actually say to me, "Why are you doing this? It's so much paperwork and it's so much time," or not really paperwork much anymore, but... And I say, look, this is to protect us. It's also to protect the data that we're gathering. I mean, what happens if we have a critical error in one of our GPS units or one of our iPads? We've got some backup data. I might have a Garmin with a GPS point for that archaeological site. So I can say, yes, we were there. And based on the track data, I was walking the boundary. You know, I've got all this just backup data. It's a little less accurate, but it's still there.
Right, right. You know, that's I'll emphasize one more time what we both kind of hit on, but just say it straight out. You might not be the one looking at the data later that's being collected.
Exactly.
Because you hit on that, Stephen hit on that. Always assume that whatever you're doing, somebody else might have to pick that up. And I really have to try to press upon that on some people I have. It's like, you know, assume you're going to be, you know, hopefully not, but assume you're going to get food poisoning tonight and just be out tomorrow. You know, I mean, you never know what's going to happen. So somebody else is going to have to pick up where you left off. And, you know, so write it down, write everything down, you know, and don't forget about it. It might seem a little tedious. And if it is tedious, we should be able to streamline these processes so it's not tedious and it's just something that just gets done, you know, and find a way to make it. Find a way to make it useful. You find that on mine sites all the time where they've got they're trying to always rework their safety procedures so it's less tedious for people. Like, I know there's mines in Nevada that have this little card that you fill out every day, and it's just that simple little check marks. What did you go over? And some fill-in blanks, and you have to turn in one of those for each person every single day, and they sign it. And that's their way of saying, you know, rather than requiring, you know, counting on somebody to just do a tailgate safety meeting and say, yeah, we did that. This is accountability, you know, and you have to do it every day. So, Bill, I know down in Arizona, you guys have the PD system down there, which from talking to you, sounds like if you don't manage that well, could be an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, it can be a complete disaster.
yeah.
One thing fast about the mines and the safety.
Yeah.
A lot of times when you're going for the proposals for being a consultant for those mines, they want to see that you have that kind of health and safety program already set up.
Absolutely.
So even if you're doing a project for the Forest Service or, you know, just a private client that doesn't actually ask for any kind of health and safety protocol, if you can show when you're writing your proposal for the mines that you are taking care of that kind of stuff and that you already have that all set up, and they can look at your forms and see that you've done it, and you can show examples and stuff, you know, that's definitely going to help you out rather than a company who has to establish that stuff after the fact just to get the contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. That's an excellent
point. They love it. They'll call you back. If you've got an established health and safety plan, you can show them that, they will call you back for more work. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and the mines, they're not like open to all these competitive bids and stuff. They're a business. Mm-hmm. So they know a company that's doing what they need done and is already on point. They don't have to, you know, set up an RFP or an RFQ and go through all the five best companies and interviews and stuff. They just call that company and say, hey, can you do it? How much is it going to cost, right? So other companies that maybe are behind the curve with the health and safety, and this is actually something that I was all about it a while ago, but I'm still all about it. You know, health and safety is super important. And there's a lot of companies that were saying exactly what you were talking about, Sonia, as far as why do we have to do this? Oh, this is just extra work. Why don't we just start walking? We'll just start walking and then we'll do it later, you know? Well, if you have it all done in advance, when you're that preferred vendor, that goes a long way. You know, they don't call anyone but you.
Yeah, that reminds me, there's a company up in that works a lot in Nevada. They're a Canadian company originally, but they have a lot of mines in Nevada called Newmont. I'm sure people who've worked up there know Newmont. And when I first started my firm, I didn't know some of the intricacies about them. I'd worked on some of their mines before with other companies, but I contacted them right out and said, hey, I'm a brand new CRM firm. And they're like, yeah, talk to us when you have a 2-year health and safety record. Yeah, because they don't deal with anyone that doesn't have at least a 2-year clean health and safety record. So stuff to keep in mind. And you know, because of that, you need to actually keep track of it. I mean, they're gonna want verification of that, that you've been in business for longer than 2 years or you've had a good safety plan in place and no major incidents in 2 years. So
exactly.
So yeah, Bill, get into the managing of your systems down there a little bit, the PD system, and maybe even talk about how you managed your excavation over the summer.
Yeah, when I came down here, I don't know if anyone's ever heard of the provenience designation system outside of Arizona. But there's several companies here that use it, and the companies that don't use it, when I work with them, I'm kind of like, you know, I barely can even remember what it was like to not use it. However, I remember the perpetual disaster of having a million unit ones, and like, you know, you would have a project where there was multiple phases, like you were saying, Chris, the multiple USGS quadrangles. And you're only supposed to do 1 through H and Q this month. And then 2 years later, you're supposed to do that one or, you know, something else. And every time you're starting the project, you're grabbing a piece of paper and saying, this is area 1. This is area 2. Well, you've already had an area 1 like 2 years ago, right? So when you're trying to put the data together, you have to try to figure out, you know, unit 1A, unit 1BZ, unit 1Q, Roman numeral, you know, X and all this stuff. And it gets super confusing, right? And then it also turns your descriptions into gibberish. So down here in Arizona, we've been using the provenience designation system. And when I first got here, I kind of didn't understand it. But now that I've had to teach it several times, you basically just use a log, a simple log that has several different elements, like UTM coordinates, what kind of a unit it is, what the thing is, and then you just give it a number, right? So each project will have numbers 1 through 1,000,000, and you just take the very next number in the log, and the numbers are all printed out on the piece of paper. They automatically are generated, right? So you just take the very next number and say, you know, number 1 is the project area, number 2 is a road or something like that, and then you write the UTMs, and you know, you record it in the Trimble, and you write down, you know, several other elements and then a little description of it, and you just keep going, right? So 5 years from now, if you have to come back to that project area and even resurvey the same piece or do more excavations in the same location, you just take the very next number. So you get your old PD log, which is all the numbers that were you generated before, and then you just start at the very next thing, right, with giving more numbers. And so you're just basically given like a numeric name, like an address, to a three-dimensional location on the earth, whether it's an excavation unit, whether it's a level in that unit, whether it's a road, whether it's, you know, a house or something like that. That's basically, you know, what you're doing there. And it's easier to keep track of all that stuff over the years. Now, the difficulty is when somebody just doesn't see the value in it and kind of refuses to learn the system because they've already done, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. So, oh, well, this is stupid. You know, it's the same as this system that I already know well. Well, that really doesn't matter. The other problem is if someone who doesn't know what they're doing, you know, starts messing with it or you know, doesn't learn it properly, then you can get a whole bunch of disasters. But yeah, this summer, everybody thought I was crazy, but I taught the provenience designation system to a whole bunch of students, you know, even volunteers and, you know, like 8-year-old children, and they were able to fill out the log.
Nice.
So it's not that hard. You just have to think about it, like, rather than, you know, thinking that there's a, you know, locus one with unit one and feature one with level one of unit one, you know, you actually break it down into, you know, this is locus five because it's the fifth thing I wrote down in the log. This is unit 23 because it's the 23rd thing that I saw. And level one of unit 23 is actually like 40 something because that's the next number that was there. And when you put them all into, so you can sort them after you put them into Excel, which I hope that I can, turn this into a digital form because I can see how it's so much easier to figure it out. But when you put it into Excel, you can sort by all the units and they'll have numbers that don't really make any sense, like 42, 73, 16, all this different stuff, right? But you'll be able to see, like, you know, level one is a 10 centimeter excavation unit or whatever, or number 25 is like the overburden that we just threw off on this hand trench or something like that. And you can sort through them that way. It actually makes it a lot easier for, you know, it makes it a lot easier for the whole project to keep track of the stuff I see in the past. And it eliminates a lot of the disasters of having to sort out what things are and rename them, like after you've already come back from the field, because they're just a random number. I mean, it's hard to explain unless I show everybody, but.
Well, and it makes sense. And basically the moral of the story is no matter what you're doing, have a clear way to record all of your data that you're not going to change midway through the project. You know, and have a method for that. Don't try to figure it out later and just get out there and get boots on ground because you're excited to get surveying. Know what you're going to do. Try to, you know, if you have a large enough staff, you know, you can have maybe a meeting beforehand and say, what are the possible things we could encounter? And how are we going to deal with that? You know, and then try to think of the things that you might not ever encounter, but hey, it's a possibility. And then try to, you know, how are we going to deal with that? What about this contingency? What about this? What about this? You might not always have the time for that, especially, you know, of a company like my size or something like that. I pretty much set this all up on my own before we started these. And then, you know, once I got into it, I was able to talk to people before we got too deep into this and really nail down some procedures. Not my ideal situation, but, you know, that's how it had to happen out here. All right. I think we're going to take another short break for one of our other podcasts on the Archaeology Podcast Network, and we'll come back and wrap this up with some of the other stuff you'll encounter with large projects. All right. Back in a minute.
All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology, but we don't do dinosaurs.
Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
All right, we're back. So one of the things, you know, we've been talking about organizing and all that stuff, and I kind of hit on this at the right before the break, but one of the things I wanted to talk about was support staff. Now, Sonia, I'm really interested to see how you answer this question, because you're in a similar situation that I'm in, but we've done things a little bit differently when we started our companies. So when you started, I mean, it was literally just you on day one, and then at some point you started hiring people. So when you got to what you would consider maybe a larger project, or even a project large enough to where you're like, I literally can't handle all these extra little steps myself, what kind of other people did you need? I mean, not just archaeologists, but what kind of other people did you need, or do you wish you had right now? which is probably a more accurate question.
Well, I definitely can say that I needed to have someone QA/QC, or QC as it were, my work. And that's somebody completely separate from the project. And that's kind of hard to find in a small business, because usually everybody's involved with a project. You know, I talked to my father-in-law, he passed away last year, but a PhD in English, essentially, did a lot of research on technical writing, and he assisted me. My husband assisted me. He's not an archaeologist at all. So what he's doing is looking at readability, whereas I have to look at content again. So a QC person who can help with that task is going to be critical, especially when you start getting into larger projects. An administrative person would be very helpful. And I would love to hire my accountants to do all of my accounting work. Beyond the general stuff that they do. I'm talking like payroll and entry of expense reports, things like that. It would just save, as a small business owner, it would save me tons of time to have someone else do that.
Yeah, because you look at all those small tasks like payroll. Like I've got a company that handles payroll for me, but I still have to go on the website, enter the hours, and you know, make sure everything's right and do all that stuff. And then when they send me the report, I've got to make sure the money gets transferred from my operating account to my payroll account. And you know, I still have to do all that stuff. And it would be nice, even though those are 5-minute tasks. You know, it adds up with the 150 other 5-minute tasks.
It's so true. Yeah. So true. We had a project, a large project, a field work last February. It kind of got it got kind of thrown at us because it was time sensitive. And we ended up renting a house and putting all the crew up in that house. But every single week I had to go in or go back to Salt Lake or Ogden, and that's like a 4-hour drive. Put in everybody's time, run payroll every 2 weeks, make sure people were getting paid. I mean, it's important to me to make sure that my crews get paid on time.
That's a good thing.
The last thing I want to do is have someone, or I want to have is someone to walk off my project because they're not getting paid on time.
Right.
You know, it's not good for them, and it's not good for me either. It's not good for the project. So that's kind of critical. Beyond that, it's just really nice to have a pool of field technicians and crew chiefs who are on call. Reliable people that know their work and do it well.
Right. Steven, how about you? You know, what kind of projects could you, you know, what kind of extra people did you need when it went from just you to needing an actual staff for some of this stuff?
Well, a lot of it was gradual buildup. That, you know, I was spending so much time in meetings that I needed, you know, beyond like just a crew chief, I needed someone who was essentially Secretary of Interior qualified on their own and could do, you know, if I handed them a project, they could basically go do the whole process through it. When we got that last contract where we were doing a lot of work, a lot of excavation, you know, we needed to add a dedicated lab staff, which in the North is pretty rare because lab work is typically reserved for that's the winter work. That's what you do over the winter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we didn't have time for that. I mean, there was no way to deal with that given the amount of stuff that was coming in and out of the field. So we had to have basically, yeah, add permanent lab staff or semi-permanent lab staff that would process the artifacts as they're coming in. And that had, you know, extra benefit of it improved, you know, the turnaround time and noticing issues, right? So it, you know, it kind of improved the quality of the work anyway, because if you're not even looking at stuff or, you know, how it's organized or the boxes until, you know, after everybody's out of the field and there's snow on the ground and you can't do anything, then you're missing like a level of quality control.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one thing we've noticed out here is we need to be, you know, because of the size of this project, we need to be hot on quality control, you know, within a very short period of time. If we were to, you know, there's other companies that are still recording stuff on paper out here. And I know for a fact that some of the smaller ones, they would wait until the end of a project like this before they digitized and processed all their site records. And the nature of a project this size, it's just, it's prohibitive to do that. I don't know how you could actually do it. You know, we process site records weekly, you know, and there's issues that come up and we might have to go back out. It's rare that we'd have to go back out to a site because something wasn't recorded or something like that. But, you know, it does happen on a project where you're recording hundreds of sites. And, you know, we've got over 1,000 isolates. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, data points that could get screwed up. And if you're not constantly error checking this stuff and QCing it, then you could run into some serious problems.
Right. Well, and I think that's, you know, that's like the big issue with large projects is that most of, you know, what we think about and as what you have to do differently, it's extra quality control.
Yeah.
You know, you can, if it's a 1 day project, you can take a certain amount of slop out in the field, get back to the lab and be able to figure things out. And you know, if it's 3 months out in the field, you know, that's, you know, multiply that amount of slop, you know, more than 90, because it just, you know, keeps going up and getting worse. And that most of what you end up doing, whether it's support staff, whether it's, you know, thinking ahead about how you're going to structure your data and your reporting and knowing the reporting requirements before you actually, you know, hop in the truck or, you know, doing the safety stuff. This is all quality control. And it's weird because it's not directly, you know, archaeology as most of us think about it, you know, that it's really hard to sell to someone who's never had to do anything more than like, you know, get one person, grab two shovels, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's really, if that's all you know as far as like running an archaeology project, it's really hard to visualize how these, you know, I don't want to call them errors because they're not even necessarily errors. It's just, you know, sloppy.
And
how it just accumulates and kind of weighs down the project on the tail end. And you know, that having it as, and I hate to say like industrialized process, but it's kind of like an industrialized process where as the data is coming in, it starts being processed.
All right. So one of the other things involved with this, and we've all kind of hit on it a little bit, is experience level required. Before I talk about that, though, I want to bring one more element into the large projects here, and that's client interactions. And, you know, Stephen, like you were saying a minute ago, you can have a small project where you just go out there, do some shovel tests, come back and write the report up in 1 day. And there's probably not going to be a lot of client interaction beyond, here's your project, thanks for the data, here's your check. You know, that's pretty much where that will end. However, with larger projects, there's going to be some intermediate steps. There might be a kickoff meeting with all the players involved so you can everybody can get on the same page and the schedule's figured out. There might be extra support staff. Like, for instance, we have unexploded ordnance technicians on our project, and we had to coordinate with that company to coordinate their guys and figure out, you know, what was going on and what kind of schedule we're going to work and things like that. Cause we're not paying them. They're being paid by the military, and it's a whole other level. And then we're dealing with the base archaeologist here who actually isn't the one in charge of our contract because the contract is by a different department in the military. But he's, you know, who we have to talk to when it comes to actual archaeology on the ground. And so there's, you know, there's that type of interaction. And then there's biweekly updates that we give to our client. My client is technically the prime contractor on this project. Their client is the military, okay? And that's the big projects here. For my stuff, like I said, I record a lot of data. I actually have a password-protected page on my website that we update every day with screenshots of our maps and what we've done and our crews and how they break down, what time they started, what time they ended, what ranges they worked in, what sites they identified and recorded, what isolates they recorded and identified, and any other pertinent data relevant to the day, whether we had weather concerns or access concerns or anything like that. And that's up all the time. I decided to do that versus, say, email, because emails get lost. Emails, you know, you get in these huge email chains and they're all over the place. It's just too complicated. So with the website, I could just update a page on the website every day and call it good. They can check it at their leisure. It's password protected, so there's no problem there. And that's it. So those are some of the things. And there might be mid project meetings as well. Steven, I'm sure you have some stuff to input on this as well, because you worked for the military, and I'm sure there were, you said you were in lots of meetings, and that's probably not unique to large projects, but probably most projects you worked on, huh?
Some of the meetings I was working on were, because I was, doing like management type stuff for like resource management type stuff.
Right.
Like Sonia mentioned about having lists, is that we would maintain a list of projects that we had to do, and then basically track the progress. Like, how many acres of it have we done? How many shovel tests have been done in this particular project area? And, I would keep it as a spreadsheet, both for, my internal process of like, making sure that we're getting everything done and keeping track on it and getting, keeping an eye on what's coming in out of the field. So we, there aren't any surprises when we get to the reporting section. I would send a scaled down version of that spreadsheet to the client on a weekly basis. And it's like, here's our progress for the week. And with the understanding that, this is a work in progress, unless the project's actually done, then, there's the chance that we might have to go out and do a little bit more, but this is the progress as we're seeing it right now. And keeping that in, keeping communication going back and forth. And if they have like a change in priorities, which happens every 10 minutes or,
right.
And they need us to go do that area first. These things happen. You need to be able to deal with that on the fly. And that's one reason why like really good recording methods, come in handy, because, going back to that slop thing, if you got a little bit of slop and all of a sudden you're jumping between, project areas, that gets messy.
Right.
But something you didn't mention is, it's like we're often subcontractors to a different contractor, and we have to work with yet other contractors, all for the same agency or what client or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You start tossing in working with stakeholders and like native populations and, traditional knowledge and stuff like that, that, we are but one piece in a larger, environmental puzzle for, a lot of these projects. And there's this, the bigger, the more complex their project is, the more coordination we end up having to do on our end with, the other contractors.
No, that's good. And one of the things you mentioned about priorities, scope priorities and changes amongst those, reminded me of something else I wanted to mention. And something that Sonia's talking about in the background chat here is changes or additions to the scope. And on a large project, your client might have, especially a large project that takes a long time, your client might have some changes in what happens with what they're doing and what they need, and not just priorities in the same project, but additions to your scope of work or something like that, or extra stuff they want you to do. And you have to watch out for that stuff too, because if that's not in your scope, then you're not budgeted for it. And on a large project, You know, maybe there's a little wiggle room in there, maybe there's not. And you need to talk to them about having a change order or something like that, you know, related to that project.
It's something that you should probably discuss with your field crews as well. I've had project managers from the client come out and start pressuring my field crews to make changes to the data recovery plan or the design. And I mean, these young professionals, they may not know any better and say, yeah, sure, we can do that. Well, what they're doing is making a commitment to the client, but it's not their job to do that, because that commitment involves a change to the contract and to the costs. So it just as a word of caution, especially to new professionals in archaeology, be watchful of that, because the client, many clients know how to pressure people for some scope creep, mm-hmm. so that they can get free work done.
Yeah, and there's not usually, I mean, I know, Sonia, you and I are probably driving around in $100,000 cars because we're business owners, right?
Yeah.
So
I'm going to laugh.
But you know, realistically though, there's not a lot of margins in these projects. I mean, even if whether you're doing a $20,000 project or a $500,000 project, there's not a lot of profit being made there, right? I mean, you're making payroll, you're keeping people employed. And Steven's mentioning that I have a Tesla in the background. I will have a Tesla someday. That's on my goals. But probably when they come down to like the $20,000 Tesla. But anyway. But yeah, that's there's not a lot of space for that. And especially, you know, look at the company you're working for too. If you're working for a massive engineering firm, and they're constantly changing things and saying, yeah, we can do that. Sure, why not? It's probably because their department is being supported by either other departments or other branches of their offices. You know, they've got this huge pool of money that they can pull from. But a smaller company like mine and Sonia's, mm-hmm. you know, what you see is kind of what you get. And there probably isn't a lot of wiggle room for a lot of that extra stuff without doing a change order.
No, we pride ourselves on keeping our quality of work high and our costs as low as we can, with and still make some profit, you know, and be successful.
Right.
But if you know, one of our crew, or even if the project manager says, oh yeah, we can do that for you, that's not a problem, there is an end result, and it does affect the business that you work for. So mm-hmm. I hate to be the money person in the conversation, but in terms of project management, it eats into your profit.
Well, this is, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is CRM. It's all about money, typically.
Of course it is.
Yeah. So.
Because we're all driving around in $100,000 cars.
That's right. That's right. You know, I need more garage space for my Teslas, plural. So, you know.
I can't tell you how many clients I've had call me and say, well, Sonia, you probably make a lot of money. You know, you're a business owner. And I was like, you know, I probably don't make much more than you do.
Yeah.
And they're like, whatever. I'm like, seriously?
Right, right.
I started this business with cash.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a lot of wiggle room.
No, not a lot. Bill, you wanted to mention something about crew accountability?
Yeah, the human factor. So we're talking about setting up systems and doing a lot of QA, which is essential. But the human factor of your crew, I mean, you guys own the company, so it matters to you. Mm-hmm. But there's some people out there that, you know, 4 months of digging shovel probes in the rain, they're going to be pretty demoralized. You know, there's other people who are going to, you know, see someone else doing all the QA and wonder, how come she always gets to sit in the truck and check the paperwork while I'm the one who's out here digging, you know? And so there can be a little bit of negativity that that creeps in. And, you know, some of that's unavoidable on a long project. I mean, I've been the bad apple more than once when I'm out in the field away from my family for extended periods. And I just like, you know, it's hard to care anymore. It's a project you never wanted to do anyway. It's hard to care. But I think one of the ways to fight that is to make people accountable for what they're doing. So the QA, you know, if somebody is starting to slack on their work or their paperwork's coming in kind of sloppy, if you can tactfully pull them aside and say, hey, I know you don't want to be here. I know that maybe things are going wrong in your life or you don't really like this project. But seriously, as Steven was saying, we're a smaller piece of this puzzle. Just because we're out here in the desert and we're not finding any sites or we're not finding very much stuff doesn't mean that you are not doing something important, because by us not finding stuff, that's almost as important as finding stuff. Now we know a whole area where there's not things, and we didn't know that before. And also, every paperwork that you, you know, fill out and do properly helps all of your crew. It helps pay your own rent, but it also helps all the people who are connected to this project. You know, this is a much bigger thing than you. I think maybe sometimes that can kind of motivate people, or try to figure out what it is that they like to do and see if there's a way for them to do some of that on the project, so that when they start complaining about, you know, oh, this sucks and I hate this and I'm not getting paid enough money and I hate this. Well, you got to do a little bit of geomorphology and you're a field tech, and we have a specialist who does that, and you pretty much shouldn't have gotten to do any of that. So if you want to keep doing more of that, you have to stay on this project that sucks.
Right. That's a good point. That's
because
a really good point.
Bad morale will drag down a project more than systems, more than anything.
Having, it will.
You know, crew mutinies, you know, sabotaged paperwork that's just shoddily done, people who are, you know, maybe badgering or trying to run roughshod over the project manager or the field director just because they're, a bad seed or a bad apple. And it takes you extra time to hire another person. It takes less effort to try and transform that bad apple into something that you can use than fire them, get a whole new person. I mean, sometimes you have to actually let people go, right? You're going to be a man down. You're going to be down a person. But it's better to have that person out of there rather than have them destroy the whole project. But I've found that a lot of times that negativity and all that stuff is really a product of the mind. And so they're walking around in the desert all day long thinking these negative thoughts. You have to find some kind of way to turn that around, or they're going to bring everybody down.
Yeah, and you know, along those lines too, I try to change up my crews. I've only got two crews, but I try to change them up every other session or so and reshuffle them a little bit so they don't get sick of each other. You know, some crews work really well together and they could probably work that way for years, and other crews don't. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just one person that needs to go to a different crew. They just need a change or something like that, you know. And not only that, but like right now I've got one crew that's pretty much full-time site recording and one crew that's still surveying, and maybe somebody's just getting tired of survey, or they're getting tired of site recording and they want to just walk some more. You know, I have the flexibility to change that up and keep things changing for them so their morale doesn't have a chance to get bad, you know, so they don't get stagnant. But you know, it's a long project and things are going to happen and you just have to be ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, just simply asking some people who are complaining or, you know, in a bad attitude about, well, what do you even want? What do you want? Well, they probably haven't even actually thought about what they want themselves. They've never thought about, well, what in archaeology do you really want to do? Just asking that question right there, no one ever asked them. They just said they wanted to be an archaeologist, and here they are with you in the desert walking around in circles with an iPad and, you know, tapping down these check boxes and having to do these safety meetings every day. And it's pretty easy if you thought you were going to be Laura Croft and you're out there, you know, doing this mundane stuff, trying not to get, you know, step on an unexploded ordnance. I mean, it's pretty easy for you to be disheartened because what you thought was going to happen is not actually happening.
Well, Bill, that's on other companies, because most of my employees, I'm pretty sure, are walking around in a euphoric state saying, I'm finally working for DigTech.
You're not supposed to eat any of those wild plants out there. You're just supposed to record them, okay?
Nice,
you know,
nice.
This really happens on the cattle call projects where the company has all their people are employed. All the people that they know that could work on the project are also on the project. And now we've got to go to Shovel Bums and get 8 more people.
Mm-hmm.
So you have no idea what's going to happen to those 8. What if that person was like, you know, had a good job in Tennessee, they got laid off, they've been working at a bar for a long time, and they're just totally disenchanted with archaeology in every single way, except they got to pay their bills and they want to still make a go at it, right? So they show up after getting walked on, and those emotions are still raw and everything. And then when it turns out that, you know, it's not what they like, then they start complaining about it, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of complaining can just bring everybody down. And I've worked on crews before where, you know, I wasn't the one complaining the most, but there was someone who just nothing was ever right. A beautiful sunny day, no, this is horrible. I hate this place. I hate this job. I hate everything. I hate right. this hotel. I hate this free breakfast. The internet's not fast enough. The fridge isn't cold enough. You know, I hate the drive. It's, you know, and they're just talking about every single thing every day. You know, it goes into your mind, and you got to try to find some kind of way to turn that around. Otherwise, a long project turns into purgatory.
Yeah, absolutely. Steven, you have a final thing to add on this?
Yeah, it's kind of building off of what Bill was talking about, but not so much about morale, is that one of my catchphrases on that last large project was that supervisors supervise. And because it's, especially for new supervisors, it when you're used to digging all the time, to turn into the person with the notebook who's making sure everybody else is doing their job, that's kind of a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Because it feels like you're not working, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you're kind of like, well, you know, maybe I'll dig a little bit. And then you miss stuff because you're too busy digging instead of, you know, looking over people's paperwork, making sure yeah. it's being filled out right, or talking them through how to do the paperwork if they're new, or talking them through how to do, you know, basically training the people to do what you need them to do for whatever your system is, whether it's, you know, this program that Bill was talking about, or you know, anything, you know, whatever the methods are, particular firm, you know, it kind of falls on the supervisor to, you know, make sure that these people know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you using the artifact tracking system? Are you using, you know, what do you collect? What are you just leaving out in the field? What do they need in their notes? And it, you know, falls on the supervisor to do that. And far too often, you know, A, supervisors don't want to do it because it doesn't feel like work, or it's the kind of work that they don't want to do. Or, you know, and sometimes for some firms, they don't, you know, want the supervisors doing that. They expect the supervisors to also be a field tech in addition to whatever supervisory stuff they're theoretically supposed to be doing.
Right.
So, if you're a supervisor, you know, and you are responsible for getting that project done, you know, and up here to be like, if you're the permit holder, then, you know, sometimes you're busy doing, you know, the QC stuff, keeping things moving, you know, making sure it's happening. And if you're not the person directly doing that, you're the person making sure that person's doing it. Supervisor, supervise. That's the catchphrase.
And going back to that real quick, because we're running a little long here, that's a two-way street too. And people who are techs on the project need to realize that there are going to be people that are supervising, and they're not going to do as much quote unquote work as you, work by like physical labor, but they are still doing incredibly important parts on the project, and you can't judge them for that. Especially in CRM, you often have the case where maybe it's a friend of yours that you've worked a long time with, and all of a sudden they're moving up just a little bit, half step ahead of you, and they're project managing or crew chiefing on an excavation or something like that, and now they're not digging at all, maybe, like you said, Steven, and they're now doing this. Some resentment can be taken in that, and you know, there can be some morale issues when it comes down to that, but you just have to realize that those are very important positions, and without those, nobody else is really staying on track, you know, and it needs to happen.
You guys are absolutely right. Supervisors do supervise, and that's their responsibility, but their responsibility is also to build people up.
Mm-hmm.
The supervisor is responsible for trying to assist with morale. Quite likely, on a large million-dollar project, your supervisor is the one that's saying, you know what? Hey, project manager, I need to reward my crew. I would really like to get a keg of beer and a bunch of pizza for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're the ones that are also seeing problems that might be arising and try to mitigate those.
Right, right. Absolutely. Okay, well, we need to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask one more question, and I think, Sonia, I'll have you field this because I think it might be an issue for you sooner or later, and I think you may have already tackled it, but you've got a large project that's coming in, or maybe you just had two large projects coming in. However you define it, you've got two large projects, and you need to hire a project manager. Mm-hmm. What qualifications are you looking for above all else that this person has that you know they can probably run this project?
The first thing that I'm going to look for is their experience. Are they a good field director? Are they good at managing people in the field? The second is, do they have any other management experience? Do they understand what a budget is? Do they know that when I say you have 100 hours to finish this work, that means you have 100 hours. You do not have 120. You have 100 hours. Do they understand that? So I'm going to be looking at qualifications for a project manager who has project management experience. And as a field director, you can have project management experience. You just may not be called a project manager yet.
Right.
So I'll be looking at that. And I also look for someone who solves problems, takes extra time to address things in the evenings. If I see or notice or in recommendations, I hear that a field director, let's just say a field director who might be applying for a project management position, just goes back to his hotel or goes to the bar in the evening or heads out and doesn't do anything else, that's not the type of person I'm looking for. I need someone who is willing to put in the extra time to make sure we have quality work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this could be a whole episode in itself, so we're going to kind of gloss over it just a little bit. But if you don't have those sorts of skills and abilities, then there are ways to get those. It might seem like there aren't any, but especially on a large project, it's your perfect opportunity to start volunteering for stuff. Because on large projects, I mean, this is one of the ways I got into one of the companies I worked for not a while back was, you know, we had a super large project. We had like four or five crew chiefs on this excavation, and they had a few people leave. And I had been volunteering for stuff. I had been putting my name out there. I had been saying, you know, stepping up and saying, you know, I want to do this. How does this work? How does this work? And when it came up to, you know, push somebody up into crew chief from field tech, I was selected amongst a couple of the people. And, you know, it was because I was making myself visible and I wanted that to happen for me, and I made it happen. So
visibility is going to be important, and I'm talking good visibility.
Yeah, good visibility, not bad visibility.
You don't want that. Bad visibility is not going to get you a promotion.
Right, right.
If you're putting in the extra time and you're volunteering, you're going to move up.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the big thing is you might not, Bill's got a whole bunch of blog posts on this, but it really is your personal brand, not just, you know, not online, but your personal brand, like on the project. If you've been on a project for a month, what would most of your crewmates, what would they say about you? How would they define you? How, when somebody says, hey, what's this person like, what are they going to say? If it's something negative, then you're probably not going to be asked to promote or be asked to take on other responsibilities that you can get experience for, if those things are negative, because nobody wants to work with somebody like that. And I have personal experience with that. I've had shifts in my attitude, so to speak, over time. But it just takes experience to realize what's going to get you ahead and what's not. And do you want to get ahead? And if you do, you also have to look at qualifications. You know, are you going to need a master's degree at this company to move up? If you don't have one, then you're probably wasting your time, and you need to either go get a master's degree or find a company you can move up in that doesn't require one. You know, just find out what's required of you to get to that point. Look at the people who are already doing that. Say, what kind of qualifications do they have? Talk to them about that. How did you get there? You know, nobody came out of college and went straight into, you know, whatever position they're in. Well, some people did, which is a problem. But so yeah, figure it out and get into those positions, and then you can be managing $7 million projects right along the right along with Sonia.
I wasn't the project manager; I was just an assistant.
Yeah, but that was valuable experience, and you were an assistant for a reason, probably.
Yes, it was. It was great experience. It was it was a complicated project, but it was fun.
Yeah, know? Absolutely.
And that's the cool thing about big projects. For the most part, they really are fun. And if you have a positive attitude, I mean, you'll go far with it, and it could keep you employed for 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely.
So, you know, have fun.
And that's a great place to end. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, happy Thanksgiving tomorrow. Eat lots of turkey, and we'll see you in the field. Thanks. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast, or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.